Now blessings light on him that first invented this same sleep. It covers a man all over, thoughts and all. Like a clock, 'tis meat for the hungry, drink for the thirsty, heat for the cold, and cold for the hot. 'Tis the current coin that purchases all the pleasures of the world cheap, and the balance that sets the kind and the shepherd, the fool and the wise man even. Now that covers a great deal about the subject of sleep. But I know our guest will have many interesting sidelights to add, and it is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Margaret Mead, Associate Curator of Ethnology at the American Museum of Natural History.
My first question, Dr. Mead, is not meant to seem argumentative at all. I'm just basically curious. How do you as an anthropologist, associate the topic sleep with anthropology?
Anthropologists are interested in everything, you know. Our laboratory is a primitive people whose whole life we study. So we have to study how they sleep and how they wake up and what they eat and how they rock the baby and how they mourn and what they believe, all of it. And as sleep is something that people spend about a third of their time doing,
that's
obviously we'd have to pay some attention to it.
Or trying to do. And I hope we can cover some of the many facets, because I don't think there's a subject. Well, just look in Bartlett's quotations. I believe next to sleep, only love has more quotations concerning...
Well, they might fit together, mightn't they?
Yes. Well, do you think that there is a general psychology, you might say, about sleep?
Well, there are things about sleep that psychologists can investigate, of course, mm-hmm. and many of them do today. Psychology investigating sleep goes way back to the days when they used to put pieces of sticking plaster on your feet just before somebody woke up, and then see what they dreamt about the sticking plaster, or ring bells, or do all sorts of things, and see whether they were dreaming or not, how deep the sleep was, all of these things. And recently, we have a whole group of specialists, Kleitman at Chicago, and DeMatt, mm-hmm. and Fisher, who've been doing a lot of work to try to figure out the relation between dreams and sleep, so that it's a legitimate field for psychology. Once you get inside people's heads, it rather belongs to psychology, and a general description of what people are doing in different kinds of societies belongs to anthropology.
Well, for something that's been a part of man and animals' life for so long, sleep as such is still quite a mystery, isn't it?
Well,
the functions of sleep, or how it accomplishes itself.
We don't know, of course, we don't know whether all animals sleep or not. Everybody's pretty convinced that a dog sleeps, mm-hmm. you know, and they're always, he switches his tail and you think he's chasing a rabbit. But there's some theorists believe that ungulates, the animals that chew the cud, don't mm-hmm. sleep. That they have to spend all their time moving food from one stomach to another, and they don't have time to sleep, mm-hmm. and they remain horizontal, but no one knows for certain. In other words, it's rather hard to define what is sleep and what isn't sleep once you get away from human beings who can report on their behavior.
Oh, that's true. There must be a great gray line between complete awakeness and awareness to the deepest sleep. You see people driving on the parkways often that seem to be in that gray line, able to function, actually, to a certain extent, but not completely awake.
Well, and these gray lines, of course, are related. I mean, drowsiness is mm-hmm. one, and hypnotic trance is another. They're all of these intervening periods between total wakefulness and deep sleep.
There have been so many arguments, Dr. Mead, about amount of sleep, of course, at various stages in our growing up and to people in general. Do you think the amount of sleep necessary to an individual depends on society and its traditions, or a basic physical pattern?
It depends on both. That is, if a society believes that sleep is good for you or absolutely necessary, if they think you'll have, in the beliefs of a given society, if you don't get enough sleep, you're going to have a headache, mm-hmm. or you're going to be irritable, or you're going to beat your wife or something. Well, then, if people don't get enough sleep, they worry, and they behave as if they hadn't enough sleep.
I can see what you mean, yeah.
And from this point of view, it's related to society. But there are also probably enormous individual differences in how much sleep people need. Mm-hmm. Some people need a lot of sleep when they're young people, and as they get older, they need less. So some old people hardly sleep at all. There are other people who sleep their heads off when they're college students, and by the time they're 60, need maybe only need much. No, that I'm saying the same thing again, am I not? There are other people who don't need much sleep when they're young.
Mm-hmm.
And as they get older,
need
sleep more and more and more, and grandfather sits by the fire and sleeps almost all day. There are people who can take cat naps and sleep for 5 minutes and are ready to go on again with life. There are people that need great big solid chunks. And these are probably individual differences in physiology and temperament. Only each society picks them up in its own way. And if a society is in favor of catnaps, everybody has to try catnapping. The ones that aren't good at it lose out. If society is against catnaps, we're against catnaps.
Mm-hmm.
We're not a good catnapping society. It isn't safe to catnap in our society. You're usually either driving a car or walking where somebody's driving a car or having to get off at the next station in the subway, and you better stay awake. But in the South Sea Islands, where I've spent so much of my time, people go to sleep when there's nothing to do.
The siesta idea.
Well, no, the siesta is a sacred time after lunch in hot climates. I think
and
that's
a beautiful time, too.
Beautiful and sacred, and no one can wake you up, and the shops have to stop and so forth. Now, I'm talking still about the quick snatched bit of sleep.
Oh.
That you know that maybe you're going to go out fishing in 10 minutes, that somebody's going to give a roar, and the fish are coming over the reef. But in that 10 minutes, you just sort of put your head down and go to sleep and wait. And or in Bali, in Indonesia, people go to sleep whenever they're anxious or worried about anything.
Oh, really?
So that you see a whole group of people sitting beside the road where there's been an accident, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and they're all almost asleep. Or I've seen a thief who was being tried by a village court that was going to decide what they were going to do with him. And as they debated on what they were going to do with him, he slowly went to sleep. Or this is, of course, in the 30s, if you'd come home to Bali and find all your houseboys asleep in the middle of the afternoon, you knew that something had happened. Something had been stolen or lost or broken, and they immediately all went sound asleep.
Isn't that contrary to our thinking about sleep? Most insomniacs who worry themselves awake all night long, that would be a great technique to learn in our modern hustle-bustle society.
Except, you know, these things aren't just techniques. They're very closely related to the whole of the rest of the society.
Mm-hmm.
If you grow up in a society where every time anybody's worried, they go to sleep, when you're worried, you go to sleep. But if you grow up in a society where everybody says, I couldn't sleep all wink last night, the minute you want to even show you're worried,
mm-hmm.
you know, you'll find 5- and 6-year-olds in our society walking around saying, I couldn't sleep a wink, I couldn't sleep a wink.
Yeah.
And they're learning very early how to be good little insomniacs.
Well, then you imply by that a person who is an insomniac because of worry could actually learn to sleep, though under mental duress.
No, I didn't. People who grow up in one culture learn something very different.
Mm.
The insomniac, the worst insomniac you know, if he'd been born in Bali and grown up there, might be able to do this, you see. And we do study other cultures in order to learn something about the range of human
mm-hmm.
behavior. We know that you don't have to treat sleep the way we do. We do know that because mm-hmm. other human beings who are just as human as we are don't. But that doesn't say that you can take an adult American and teach them to catnap easily or
mm-hmm.
teach them to sleep in the daytime, teach them to sleep in two lumps, as many people who live in the tropics do. I find it very hard to come back to this climate and not be able to sleep after lunch.
You speak of climate. Do you think that plays its role, too, then?
Oh, in hot climates, the desire to sleep in the daytime is a great deal stronger. Now, there are people, Americans, don't believe in siestas, no matter where they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they go to Fiji, and they get up in the morning, and they stay up all day. Or they go to Washington, which is a nice tropical climate, only we won't admit it, and go around all summer fully dressed with collars on mm-hmm. and work all day in their offices. So that you can take a non-siesta habit into a siesta country, if you wish. But in general, most people who've lived a long time in a hot climate tend to break their sleep into two halves. You go to sleep in the middle of the day because it's so hot.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it cools off, it's delicious. And you want that lovely, cool time. And you don't want to go to sleep. So you stay up until 12 or 1 and really break your sleep into two halves.
Would you say, Doctor, then, have the sleeping habits of man changed much since we can see outside influences in taking from primitive man, have we really altered our sleeping pattern very much?
Well, you see, primitive man has sleeping patterns, too. I mean, we don't know anything about any human beings whose life isn't patterned.
Mm-hmm.
It may be patterned in very different ways. Very primitive people have very poor lights. And this is a very important thing about sleep, you see.
That's true, yeah.
If all the lighting you have is from a fire or a torch made of palm leaves or something of that sort,
mm-hmm.
Well, you don't walk around at night if you can help it because you've got such poor light, and you tend to go to bed and early because there's nothing else to do and get up as soon as it's light again mm-hmm. and go on with life.
Would you say that there's any relation beyond the actual just getting more or less horizontal about sleeping arrangements in the modern home? Would that affect modern sleep?
Well, in every country, in every society, you have very special arrangements for sleep. You know, where people sleep, mm-hmm. where the father sleeps and the mother, where the old grandmother sleeps if she's there. Among Russian peasants, for instance, she used to sleep on top of the stove. The old people were just put
really?
Up on the stove to keep warm. And there's a tremendous difference, of course, between cold countries and warm countries. Cold countries, you have to have bedding,
mm-hmm.
and you have to really work out how to keep people warm. So one of the first things that the Eskimo did when they built a snow house was to build the bed and put the fur on it to keep it warm. And in our own tradition, not so very long ago, of course, we had cold bedrooms, awfully cold bedrooms.
Oh, I can remember them.
And you'd go up to bed at night in this very cold room. And for quite a long time, we've changed all our clothes at night and put on our sleeping clothes. Well, this is a terrific operation, especially in a cold country where people wear a lot of clothes. You don't just pop into bed for 10 minutes if you have to take off everything you've got on and put on something else, down to the baby, you know,
mm-hmm.
every time a baby goes to sleep. Traditionally, we have taken off what it had on and put on something else. The Russians don't do that either. They swaddle their babies. They unswaddle them, feed them, swaddle them up again. And so night and day are more alike to them. But one of the ways we teach our babies that night is the time you and nap. Night mm-hmm. and naps are when you go to sleep, is by changing their clothes and teaching them only to be able to sleep when they have another kind of clothes on. We also teach them, of course, that darkness is when you go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You turn out the light and you make them go to sleep. Well, now in the tropics, in a place like New Guinea, you can go to sleep anywhere. You can go to sleep under a tree, over a log. You can go to sleep. Little boys in the Admiralty Islands used to go to sleep curved over a great big wooden drum, if you think of a drum about half the size of a barrel, and they would simply drape themselves over it, head down one side and feet down the other.
What was the purpose of that?
Well, just a resting place to go to sleep. Now, they slept too hard, I always felt. They could sleep through anything, on anything, under anything, and it was very hard to wake them up. And they woke up sort of dopey.
Hmm.
Also, they used to wake up screaming sometimes. The children used to cry for food, and they would start crying before they woke up with an awful yell, and then wake up in a rage demanding something or other. This is probably sleep that's a little too hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's both too easy to find a place and sleeping too hard. But, for instance, when I was working in New Guinea, and I'd be waiting for a ceremony to start, and mightn't start till 3 hours after everybody had estimated it would start, and I'd taken so many notes it was going to take 3 days to write them up, and there was no use taking any more of this. That I could just curl up on the floor, on a mat, or a piece of bark on the floor, and go to sleep, you see.
Oh, you developed a technique yourself,
Oh,
then.
I've developed all these techniques. But in Samoa, when I would go and live in a native house, and they had to make me a bed commensurate with my rank,
mm-hmm.
it took two girls all morning to make a bed with enough thin, beautiful mats on it, arranged perfectly, to give me the right eminence off the coral rubble floor to sleep on.
Well, are you inferring then that in our modern American society that we might be violating some of these casual sleep habits by over-arranging our sleeping habits?
There are a few things that have changed recently. We tend now, of course, to try to keep the temperature just even.
Mm-hmm.
Summer and winter, day and night, so we don't wear as many clothes anymore, and it doesn't take as long to get mm-hmm. undressed and to get dressed, and the baby doesn't wear as many clothes as it used to, so that we don't make as big a division between night and day as we used to. But still, on the whole, Americans find most adult Americans and older children have a lot of trouble taking naps. And they aren't able to take advantage of that extra 10 minutes or 20 minutes.
Oh, yes.
When you could get very much refreshed if sleeping weren't such a production.
Well, I found in my own case that I work kind of the opposite. Maybe it's because of duress or in this business you learn to grab the 10 minutes. But often I can cork off soundly sitting in my chair in the living room where I can't at night when I lie down.
That's
I don't know why. I think maybe I'm just in a hurry then, so I sleep fast or something. Okay. But it's very pleasant and refreshing.
Well, very likely this not going to sleep at night goes back to having been put to bed on time. You see, this is another thing we do that most primitive people and even most other peoples don't do. This notion that children of a given age ought to go to bed at a given time, whether they're sleepy or not.
Mm-hmm.
So American children spend their lives being stuck in bed when they're not sleepy and calling and asking for a glass of water and getting attention from their parents, and they get habits of insomnia. Whereas in most native communities and in many peasant communities, you just carry the baby around till it's sleepy.
Mm.
When it's so sleepy it falls asleep in your arms or on the floor, you pick it up and put it in bed.
Well, you would recommend then a more casual and less regimented approach to sleep. Let it come as a natural thing, just like hunger, and associate a natural habit with sleeping?
It would be very nice, but it doesn't go with the commuting trains.
That's true.
And with the older children getting to school,
mm-hmm.
and with all the things that mother has to do, so that we might relax some, but I don't think we're going to relax to the level of a South Sea Islander. I'm afraid not.
Well, I can see where our technique of sleeping, good or bad, is pretty well established by that 9-to-5 job and the train you have to catch and everything else that is running by the clock. We almost have to force ourselves into sleeping whether we want to or not. Do you, in studying all these people from the primitive, semi-primitive to the modern, do you think that with the injection of light available now, that we can have day or night whenever we wish, that we necessarily must sleep at night?
No, it isn't necessary. In World War II, we made some effort in some places to run on a 24-hour schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Americans really never completely made it. I mean, you still had to eat breakfast at certain hours, and if you were awake, it was breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were asleep, you slept through breakfast, you had nothing but two lunches and a dinner because we were so fixed in our behavior. Moscow is the only city, as far as we know, that ever went on 24-hour time. It did during World War II. You could have your hair cut or your back rubbed or whatever it was you needed at
mm-hmm.
any hour, your teeth fixed. Everything went right around the clock.
Was it successful? I mean,
they were working under terrific duress the way
yes.
we were, and a war isn't a very good time to test this out. But we do know that there are lots of people in the world who don't come to till several hours after they wake up. And if you make them get up in the early morning and go to work at once, we lose hours and hours and hours of valuable time. And then they can't bear to go to sleep because they haven't been awake very long. So they stay up till 2 in the morning, and then they're tired, and this gets to be a worse cycle. I think that if we could build a world, and I think someday we'll be able to do it, that does run 24 hours around the clock, and the night people work at night, and the day people work in the daytime, this we might make a tremendous difference in the use we could make of people's talents and potentialities.
The productivity then could be better used to associate with a natural metabolism rather than a clock hanging on a wall someplace.
I think so.
Sounds like a fascinating idea. It would solve a lot of problems for people who complain, I just can't do anything in the morning till I've had a cigarette and a cup of coffee. They have a legitimate argument, apparently. Well, Dr. Mead, the only trouble we have right here among ourselves is time, brief time. A pleasure talking with you about sleep.
To sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. You know, dreaming is the subject of so many poems, songs, conversations, and even psychoanalysis, and still it is a greatly unexplored area of human activity. Today we shall be exploring this subject of dreams with Dr. Margaret Mead, Associate Curator of Ethnology at the American Museum of Natural History.
What is actually dreaming? I mean, what is going on inside of our heads when we're indulging in dreams?
Well, you realize that the only way we can find out what happens when people are dreaming is by what they say after they wake up. They do have ways now, they think, of finding out whether people are dreaming or not by photographing the movements of the eyeballs. And but then they wake the dreamer up, or the sleeper up, and ask him if he was dreaming. But they're still dependent on what he says. This is something where if we didn't have words, we wouldn't be able to find out anything at all. Now, dreams are recognized in every part of the world. There aren't any people we know of who don't report dreaming, no matter how different their beliefs are.
Mm-hmm.
So that we think that dreams are a real phenomena of human behavior, although people think very different things about them. Now, what goes on is that one has apparently a lot of images. Visual images, sounds, sights, smells, tastes, feelings of movement. And you may feel as if you're running, but probably that only means that there's a slight twitch somewhere in a muscle. And all of these, when the dreamer wakes, the dreamer redoes into some more coherent story, more in words. But we don't know what function dreams serve.
I was going to ask, usually in nature there's some reason, however oblique or vague, do dreams clarify themselves in our minds, or do they serve any mental function, do you think?
Well, there's some psychologists who believe that the purpose of dreams is to protect your sleep. That you're, if things that are frightening or make you too anxious or something of the sort are beginning to intrude on your consciousness, the dream disguises them, dresses them up in a theatrical costume, and keeps you asleep. That's one school of thought. There's another school of thought that thinks that dreams wake you up, and that the function of dreaming is to keep the individual from being in too deep a sleep, so that he wouldn't respond, for instance, if there was fire or danger or something of the sort. Then there's another theory of sleep, of dreams, rather, and of course this is related to sleep, of dreams that we use a very old kind of thought in dreams that we don't use very much today in everyday life. It's the kind of thinking that you get in poetry, too, and in art, in religious experience, where images mean a great deal, and where you don't put things down 1, 2, 3, 4 the way we do in our rational everyday planning. And that this is a very old habit of man's brain, going back hundreds and hundreds and millions of thousands of years and maybe more, and that we still need to exercise it. That is, people who don't have a chance to think in this way, at least during their hours of sleep, will be deprived in some way, and possibly not as mentally healthy as people who have a chance to use it.
I mean, it might be what you would say to our physical body the appendix is, a residual primitive form of
thinking? Well, I don't think it's quite as residual as that. It's more like the fact that we have the kind of body that was meant to walk, to move, to climb mountains. Mm-hmm. Now, people who sit all day in a desk, and ride to work in a car and never get any exercise suffer in all sorts of ways. You know, they have the middle-aged back that's yes. characteristic of this whole country. And you can say that man's body was meant to use, and to hold it down to desk tasks is bad. Well, you can say the same sort of thing about the kind of thinking that comes up in dreams. This is equally true of poetry, ritual, of theater. And as we have less poetry in our lives and less emphasis on religious ritual and less emphasis on the theater, about the only place that the average person today can use this part of this, it isn't really a part of one's brain in a physical sense, but this kind of thinking is in dreams. And this may be one of their functions.
Would you then I think you've stated rather well already that it is our day-to-day pattern and associations, tastes, smells, and the sensations that create the element of the dream we'll have tonight. Do you think that
happened a long time ago, too. You see, many people have recurrent dreams that they've had all their lives. Some of them are delightful dreams. Some of them are nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have dreams that are premonitory. You know, if they're awfully worried about something, they're likely to have the same dream. And then there are very widespread basic dreams of falling, of flying, that may go way back before Homo sapiens and into pre-human times, possibly when people lived in trees or something of those, that sort. Just as the infant's reflexes when it's born can still hold on, you know, to a rod. If you give rod to a newborn baby, it holds on with a grasp that once would have made it possible to hold on to its mother's fur in an earlier, some earlier form of life.
Instinctive thinking, animalism, actually, then.
I don't like the word. What's the word animalism got to do with it? I don't like words like animalism.
I'm not an anthropologist.
This is our biological heritage, which we share with many other creatures.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you said that, of course, the great knowledge that we have, or the limited knowledge we have of dreams, depends on the person themselves, are there people who do not dream?
There are individuals who do not report dreams. We haven't done a big enough study yet of large samples of individuals photographing eye movements to be sure whether there may not be some individuals who don't dream. It seems unlikely, but there are individuals who don't remember their dreams. And to all intents and purposes, therefore, they might as well not be dreamers.
You associate the type of sleep and variations in sleep with societies. Would that same correlation hold true in dreams in other societies than ours? Are dreams as much a part of their life?
Well, sometimes they're much more a part of their lives. There are societies where almost everything you do has to be authorized by a dream. It's a source of a new song, for instance, and somebody has to dream it if it's to be used, or a new design on a pot, or something of that sort. Then there are societies where dreams are premonitory and warn people about what they better do or what they better not do. There are places where you dream before you know what you could name your child. There, we have very interesting accounts of one society where people are, you have sort of a postgraduate course in dreaming.
really?
The children start out dreaming very much like most children. Most children in most parts of the world, dreams are very simple. They dream about ice cream and cake or the equivalents. They wish they could go to a party or the new bicycle. Simple things, wish fulfillments, and simple frightening things, too, bears under the stairs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you go up into more complicated dreams. And in this particular group in Malaya, the young men that are going to be the wise men, the shaman of the society, then join a sort of seminar in dreams. And they tell their dreams, and the dreams are criticized and discussed. And it's pointed out to them that they aren't having very good dreams, and they aren't very constructive. And they learn how to dream constructive dreams. And this puts you at the high point intellectually in the society.
Well, you actually, then, again, the potential of being able to control your dreams.
Control your dreams and give them style and give them form. So some societies just leave dreams, as it were, and you tell them if you think about it.
Mm.
Others turn them into all sorts of uses. you know, among the Iroquois Indians, people used to be allowed to act out their dreams once a year, and they had something called a Feast of Dreams. So that dreams are one of the possibilities of human behavior that you can make a lot of or very little.
I was wondering about these fellows who improve on their dreams, since it's a pretty secret room he's working in there, his dream world. Do you think any of them fake it? I mean, do you really think that they're actually improving their dreams, or do they womp them up after they wake up?
Well, it's exceedingly hard to tell, see, because we know that after the alarm clock rings, someone can dream a whole plot, which would make maybe 20 pages of a novel, ending up with a shot in this dream, which is really the alarm clock or the knock on the door.
That, yeah.
So that dreaming is very, very fast. And in the moments after you wake up, or just before you wake up, you can reconstruct them and rehash them into all sorts of forms. But of course, for instance, in psychoanalysis, the analyst teaches the patient, or the analyst son, to dream. And to dream certain kinds of dreams. If you have a Freudian analyst, you learn to dream Freudian dreams. And if you have a Jungian analyst, you learn to dream Jungian dreams. And your dreams are the way you communicate to your analyst. He knows how to evaluate them and how to, you free associate to your dreams. And this gives you a kind of communication. And so that's certainly a case where people learn to dream in particular ways. And if we collect all the dreams of a group of Indians, of Winnebagos or Zuni Indians or something, they run in the same style. It's not only the content, of course, will be different, whether they're full of buffalo or Indian corn or deer or tigers or something, mm-hmm. but also the style, the actual literary style, will vary from one group of people to another in the way that they tell their dreams.
Isn't that strange? What is your personal opinion about the analysis of dreams in that field? Are you speaking of Jung and Adler?
Well, this is a way of gaining access to parts of people's lives that ordinarily they don't have much access to. And just as a sleep gives one a chance to think in ways that one wouldn't be able to think
That's
otherwise.
True.
So being able to communicate with one's own unconscious is a very useful thing. In fact, there's a new type of experimentation going on now to see what it would be like if people slept in water, in salt water, instead of sleeping on beds.
Sleeping in the water?
Sleeping in a special kind of bed in which you put salt water and your head's on sort of a water wing and you just float. And this is supposed to be very relaxing. It gives you about, theoretically, 4 hours sleep will give you 8 hours rest. And one of the questions that I'm interested in is, do you dream as much? Or are you cutting out 4 hours of dreaming? And this I would object to. Otherwise, it sounds very interesting. Otherwise, I could use the time very nicely.
Yes, I was going to say that it would be handy. It might spring a leak halfway through the night or something. I'm not sure I'm quite associated with the sleeping in the water. It sounds dangerous, if nothing else.
No, well, the danger can be controlled. Mm-hmm. And you see, you're gravity, you're weightless.
Oh,
in the
that's
water.
True. Yes, it would relax the muscles.
Yeah,
more
and
than
the thing that tires people out is thrashing around on that bed all night long. Mm-hmm.
I imagine you could learn to sleep under specific conditions, much as our spacemen of the future must.
Yeah,
I'm
and
sure.
Balinese sleep standing up in a crowd. They go to the theater and stand jam-packed around a square theater, and when they're bored, they go to sleep. There are people in front of them and behind them. And
I've seen them on the subway doing that, too. What was it? She finally fell down to the 125th Street. Well, Dr. Mead, is there any relation, then, since dreaming seems to be a semi-controllable element of thought there, is there any relation between the dream and extrasensory perception? Would they lap one over the other?
Well, people who are very sensitive to what goes on around them and pick up many small cues that other people don't pick up, mm-hmm. Slight movements of the hands or the eyes and things of this sort, may then dream about things that the people who they were with don't know they know. Now, if you wake up the next morning, therefore, and tell a dream that is about something that your son or daughter or father or mother thought you didn't know anything about, this will look very much like extrasensory perception.
Oh. I was wondering, too, in thinking again of dream, the you might say the self-imposed sleep of self-hypnosis or drug hallucinations. Would that be classified as a dream? I was thinking particularly of the eating of certain mushrooms in Mexico where they have highly colored hallucinations.
Well, we call that hallucinatory phenomena. They're like dreams in their form. The logic, the grammar is very much the same, mm-hmm. but they're differently induced. If they're induced by a drug or by hypnosis, this will differ from simply occurring in natural sleep.
But it would be the same basic function, whatever that is, in dreaming.
You just make it
yourself.
Yes.
A do-it-yourself dream kit. A little mushrooms down in my cellar growing now. I guess, again, you have to depend on the communication between the individual who has had the dream and what you find out about it. Do people dream, since they can control it to some extent, in sequence? Chapter one tonight and chapter two tomorrow night?
There are people who have novelistic dreams, and there are people who have characters that come and go in their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Who can order a good dream for tonight? There are not very many of those, mm-hmm. but it can be done. Now, we've never yet done a really good study, and we ought to, but this hasn't been done, about a full study of the relationship between dreams and painting and ritual in a given society to see how they all fitted together. We don't really know whether people who have no poetry or art in the daytime have duller dreams at night. It seems to look that way. But it could work either way. You see, it could be that if you have a very dull life in the daytime, you could have a very rich life at night.
Mm-hmm.
Or if richness is dependent upon the same factors, sleeping or waking, if you just have a dull culture, you'd be dull in the daytime and dull at night both. And if you have a rich culture, you'd be rich, have a rich poetic imaginative day and a rich poetic imaginative night. And this is never being fully enough worked out. We don't know what the relationships are here.
Well, it would seem that one would foster the other. I mean, a cursory thinking that if you went to an opera that evening, your dreams of that night would be more likely about Verdi than rock and roll. The daily stimulus should heighten.
Well, daily stimuli do have a lot to do with it, but this could be at a pretty dull level. You know, you can be dull about an opera or bright.
You said in referring to the aqua bed or the sleeping in salt water that if you had to give up that four-hour sleep that was related to dreaming, you would object.
Well,
do you personally like to dream?
I like dreaming.
Oh.
And so this would be one of the questions I'd ask. You see, I think this idea of relaxing in soft water, buoyant soft water, and really relaxing one's muscles sounds like a very good idea. It might be revolutionize our sleeping habits. The one question I would ask, though, is, what's it going to do to our dreaming?
You seem to cover them very kindly. Do you dream in black and white or color?
Sometimes in black and white, sometimes in one color, you know, as if I was rather a mingy, cheap publication. And sometimes in full color. And I solve a good many scientific problems in sleep, too, which is one of the things that a great many people do. You have something that you haven't quite solved, and you put it in the back of your mind, and after a while you have a dream that will give you a clue.
Do you find that really productive thought coming from dreams?
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
When you write them down?
This can be quite productive and give you the next integration in something that you're working on. A great many scientists report solving things in sleep. Sometimes they remember the dream. Sometimes they just wake up with a solution.
Well, this would then come into the field that they're experimenting with now, and they have quite a bit in the past, is teaching while sleeping. Would that... That would be relative to that thought.
Teaching while sleeping is different. I mean, that's simply using the fact that one's very relaxed to get something onto a repetitive habit basis. It's a little different from saying to oneself, now, what is the solution of this? What is the solution?
Yes,
what is the solution? And then going to sleep and letting your mind go to work on it.
Oh, I can see where one is just a matter of absorption and the other is a matter of constructive thought. You know,
that's right.
But at least the mind is there and working even though we are sleeping.
Yeah, and the question is, of course, how hard we ought to have it working.
We have had the pleasure of talking with Dr. Margaret Mead, Associate Curator of Ethnology at the American Museum of Natural History.
We've been talking with Alex Randall most of the week about dreaming. We've talked about what various dreams mean. Today, he's going to tell us how we can tune in to our own dreams.
One of the things that's important is that when you keep a journal or keep a record of your dreams, I encourage people who wish to tune in on this free movie theater that they tune in on the movie theater by starting a kind of newspaper, a magazine for themselves, a journal in which their own dreams can go and live. Well, then they're tuned in and they fine-tune the television set of their own mind so that they're able to see these pictures more clearly. That these people get to watch the pattern of the recurring dream much more so than the person who's attending once in a while. The person who's keeping a record has some way of seeing when they occur, what events occurred during the day before them, what's coming up that this might be pointing to.
That would be great to do, but there are times when I dream and can't remember what the heck it was I've dreamed. I wake up in a sweat or...
But Jean, do you have a journal?
No, I don't.
Do you have a place for them to go?
Yeah.
See, this is where, this is a problem that most people who are listening to us right now are going to be facing, is they say, well, listen, Doc, I mean, it's great that you can sit there and talk about going to sleep and dreaming. That's great because you probably get to sleep in every morning, all that kind of stuff. But hey, I got to work every morning, and I don't remember most of the time. And it's true, and I agree with them. But the first thing that you have to do is not say, I will have a dream and then do something with it. The first thing you have to do is say, I, the conscious me, wants to remember them. If the conscious me wants to remember them, if the conscious me, the one that's listening to the radio right now, or the one that's working right this minute, or for all those people who aren't listening to us while they're working on some task, you listen up now, because you can remember all of them. And all you have to do is make a small effort to pay attention. Those two words are all it is. I tell my students that's the whole class. I give them the whole class in two words. All you who don't want to take University of Maryland's dream seminars, you can hear, get the whole class in two words. Pay attention. And the easiest way for your dreaming mind to pay attention is to make a little ritual of writing every morning. Now, most people don't write ever in their lives. Few of us ever write letters to our parents. But to make that little effort that for the first 5 minutes of the morning, I'm entitled to that 5 minutes. My mind is entitled to 5 minutes before the coffee, before the bathroom, before I have to run out to the car, before I have to run to work. I'm entitled to 5 minutes before the kids. That's my 5 minutes. Then the rest of the world has its time. My 5 minutes, I get to lie there in bed, and during that time, I can just doze a little bit. I'm not sound asleep. I am awake. I'm allowed to just kind of be mellow for a couple of minutes with myself, and then I have a notepad, and I write. Now, that means that there are lots of mornings I've awakened and gone, Alex, I've got a dream. And that morning I write too. I write down that I didn't have the dream and why I didn't have it. Was I too late waking up? Did I lie in bed too long and forget it? Write it down so that I make the ritual of writing a little bit every morning. Then the morning that I remember just a little weensy tiny bit of a dream, I start to write that little tiny bit down. The rest of the dream jumps out on a piece of paper. And you kind of train your mind then. It's just, listen, it's just like training yourself to do anything else. You can train yourself to do 100 sit-ups. You can train yourself to do a 20-mile hike. You can train yourself to be tuned in on the inside of your brain. And for all intents and purposes, it's as significant a part of your body as the muscles, as the stomach, as your feet, as everything else. You've got this little part of you that is a picture maker, that is an idea generator, that is a who are you describer that's helping you understand who you are. Well, it's right there. All you have to do is tune it up the same way you tune a television, the same way you tune your muscles to run, the same way you make pretty babies. It's the same part of you that's working, and it's there to help you.
You teach courses for the University of Maryland
most of the time, yeah.
The psychology of dreaming, and you also hold seminars during
mm-hmm.
the term.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone is interested in attending either the course or the seminar, who can they contact?
Well, the University of Maryland has me scheduled to teach a few weekend seminars, most in the afternoons and Saturdays and things like that. And the University of Maryland office on your base will be able to sign you up for these classes. As far as wet dreams go and dreams of passion, it's intriguing in this light that most women tend to dream about their spouses in terms of dreams of passion, while most men tend to dream about other women, which is a commentary on the status of American society. We've trained our men one way, we've trained our women another way. The dreams tend to occur in times when people are not being gratified sexually, when they're frustrated. But will also occur amongst people who are just highly sexed during a particular time. People, we're all on phases, we're all on cycles, some more obvious than others. Men have biological cycles that they're going through, and we all have lifelong cycles that we're going through. Well, these cycles sometimes set us up for kind of periods in our lives of passion, and they'll be marked with wet dreams or with dreams of passion.
Recurring dreams. They've always been said to have mean something really deep and foreboding.
Sure.
Well, is that the case?
Well, you know, Gene, the thing is that your brain doesn't dream something unless it's got a reason to. And one of the, I think it's one of the hardest things for people who haven't examined their dreams to accept is that these are not random. They're not chaos. It's not just a slice of a minute of television commercial sliced out all through the day and all jammed together. The dreaming mind chooses this stuff. And it's just, the dreaming mind isn't going to be any better at choosing what goes on in a dream than a person's conscious mind is at dealing with conscious time. The person whose life is chaos during the day, who has no control over what they're doing, who is miserable all the time or just can't get it together, that person is going to have chaotic dreams. And the person who's beginning to say, I want to have some control over my life, I want to be a significant part of choosing and planning my own destiny, I want to be a powerful figure in determining how I live my life, that person's going to start having not just coherent dreams, but dreams that start providing guidance, signposts, markers. I remember the time I began to think about this idea for the first time myself. I started having dreams about a man who was making signs. He was making signs. He was planting them in the ground and showing me different pathways and directions, saying, you go this way, you go this way. He's really just a part of me talking. So it was a recurrent dream of one theme that's expressing a state of being at that particular time in my life. Now, for most people, recurrent dreams, they come two ways. You get recurrent nightmares, which really reflect back on this whole nightmare business, that we've got a recurring daytime pattern. The wife who's tormented by the wife-beating husband, or the child who's tormented by the teacher at school that doesn't understand him, or the guy who goes to work and has a supervisor he's got to face for 3 years who's a turkey. That person is going to have gobble, gobble, cluck, cluck turkeys in his dreams recurrently. And he's going to be dreaming out every night the nonsense of the daytime that he has to go through with. So the recurring dream, in a sense, is many of them are just statements of a recurring misery during the day or recurring patterns during the day. Now, the other thing that comes in with recurring dreams is we find that lots of them are dreams, recurring dreams of upcoming events that have not yet been fully realized. We have not yet fully got an idea. We're anticipating a job change. We're anticipating getting out of the service. We're anticipating another child. And we'll have recurring dreams around these themes. There may also be other kinds of recurring dreams that are not yet clear as to what they have to do with us.
Tomorrow, we'll find out how we can take a look at these dreams and find out what they mean ourselves. Alex Randall and Dreaming.